From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll tell you about all the ways you can vote in next week's primary election. Then, the authors of The Steal talk about the people who attempted to overturn the 2020 election and those who fought to preserve democracy.
Both Matt and I never expected when we started working on this book that we would discover, you know, the real heroes of the story were very often Republicans and very often avid Trump supporters.
Plus, we'll learn which Milwaukee neighborhoods continue to be deeply segregated and where it's becoming more diverse.
We see frustratingly little change compared to 2010, so everything you have heard in the past about segregation in the Milwaukee area is still true. There is a small amount of change, particularly in certain suburbs.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here's today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. Milwaukee has ranked as the second most segregated metro area in the U.S. between black and white populations. Later in the show, we'll explore which neighborhoods continue to be segregated and where it's becoming more diverse. First, Wisconsin's primary election is just 1 week away. There have been a lot of changes when it comes to voting rules and regulations recently, including the removal of ballot drop boxes and Republicans dismissing a regulation that allows election clerks to fill in missing information on absentee ballots. But there are still several different options when it comes to casting your ballot on or ahead of Election Day. For a primer on all the ways you can vote ahead of Election Day, WUWM's Mayon Silver spoke with Neil Albrecht, the former executive director of the Milwaukee Election Commission.
So we're very fortunate in the state of Wisconsin that anyone can request a by-mail absentee ballot. We are what's called a no-excuse state for absentee voting. As long as they are eligible to vote and as long as they are registered to vote at their current address.
And people can go to register online at myvote.wi.gov. Is that correct?
They can. So if a person needs to update their registration, the best way to do that is at the MyVote website, where they can register if they are a new Wisconsin voter. They can also update their registration if they were previously registered but have moved since then. And again, they would want to complete that process before requesting an absentee ballot.
And what do you need to register to vote?
So Wisconsin has something called a proof of residence requirement in order to register to vote. Basically, some sort of an acceptable document that includes your name and your current address, the address that you're going to be registering at, and it proves that you reside at that address. So some of the more commonly presented proof of residences include things like your Wisconsin driver's license or your state ID, if they have your name and current address on them. A bank statement, a utility bill, a paycheck stub, any correspondence, like any document that you've received from a unit of government. It's a pretty extensive list. Also things like a lease, a property tax bill, a receipt for paying your property taxes. I think that there are a number of good options for residents.
So when people register, they need to show their name and current address, but they don't need to show a photo ID when they're registering.
That's correct. It's really kind of a two-step process. First, you have to prove your residence when you register to vote by meeting the proof of residence requirement. Second, you need to prove your identity by providing your photo ID when you actually are requesting a ballot or voting on Election Day.
Gotcha. Well, and what else do people need to know about registration?
So you have to meet the qualifications to vote in order to register, which is you cannot be serving probation or parole for a felony conviction. You have to be 18 years of age by Election Day, and you have to be a U.S. citizen. You also have to be a resident at the address that you are registering to vote for at least 28 days before the election. That means you have to be residing at your address for at least 28 days prior in order to register to vote at that address. If you have moved within that 28 days, it's actually okay to continue to vote from your previous address.
And so someone's, let's say they're registered to vote, what are the three ways that they can vote now?
So they've got three good options. The first one I'll say is the one that we encourage because it is the safest in terms of health and safety and the pandemic, and that is to request an absentee ballot by mail. So that would be a ballot sent to a voter's home or mailing address. So there's by mail absentee voting. There will continue to be in-person absentee or early voting at sites across the city in the 2 weeks preceding the election. And then, of course, there is voting at a polling place on election day.
And let's talk about mail-in voting in particular. How does someone request a mail-in ballot?
So the easiest way to request an absentee ballot is to do so at that MyVote website. I think we're kind of covering a couple of times here. This MyVote website, which is offered by the state, is really the easiest public access to voting besides going to a polling place on election day. At that MyVote site, you can register to vote, you can request an absentee ballot. You can confirm your voting site, you can confirm your registration status. It's really good for members of the public to develop a familiarity with that website. But I also recognize that not everyone in the city of Milwaukee has access or consistent access to the internet. So if going to that MyVote website is not a good option for requesting an absentee ballot, they can go to any number of Milwaukee Public Library branches and they can go and request assistance with the absentee application process. The final option would be just go ahead and call the Election Commission at 414-286-3491 or 414-286-VOTE. Just identify that you would like to receive an absentee ballot for the upcoming elections, and staff are available to provide assistance with people in order to complete that request process.
And what's the deadline for requesting a mail-in ballot?
So the deadline for most voters is the Thursday preceding the election. If it is for a voter that is indefinitely confined, and I'll provide the definition, a voter I can identify as indefinitely confined if they are unable to appear to vote on election day due to age, illness, or disability, they actually have until the Friday preceding the election to make that request. So Thursday for most voters, Friday before the election for those that identify or certify as indefinitely confined. I do want to add that even though state statutes have those deadlines in place, I would not encourage people to wait until those deadlines to request their absentee ballots.
And what's the deadline for returning the ballot?
Your ballot has to be received by 8 p.m. on election day.
And can you talk about the witness signature very briefly?
Yeah, it's very important that anybody voting by mail absentee follow each step of the instructions that's provided with their absentee ballot. One of those instructions is you have to have a witness signature on your absentee ballot. That's somebody who will sign and provide their full address as verification that you are the person who voted your absentee ballot. That can be a spouse, a roommate, a neighbor. They can sign as your witness. I know that some people actually even use their postal carrier to sign as their witness, and then they ask that postal carrier to take the ballot with them.
And can you talk about ballot tracking at all? Do the ballots get tracked both when they're sent from the municipal clerk's office and then when they're returned by the voter?
Yeah, so the state of Wisconsin phased in intelligent barcodes on absentee ballots. So they are tracked from the moment that the mailing label is generated until it actually goes out in the mail, till it's received by the voter, mailed back to the election commission. You can track the status of your absentee ballot. It's really to improve the performance of by-mail absentee voting in the state of Wisconsin. You do that on the MyVote website. So again, it's a terrific site to voters who really want to be informed in terms of voting options, how to register, how to request an absentee ballot, and then how to track your ballot.
All right. Well, Neil Albrecht, thanks for sharing how to vote and how to vote by mail.
Thank you for inviting me on the show.
Neil Albrecht is a former executive director of the Milwaukee Election Commission. He spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver, and this conversation was recorded in 2020. The House committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol has wrapped up its hearings for the summer, but more are expected next month. The hearings revealed more details about what happened that day, including the actions of then-President Donald Trump. A book that came out earlier this year called The Steal brings us back to the days of counting that followed the 2020 election, the moments that are now under investigation, and it profiles the people who created and aided the crisis that ensued. The book was written by Mark Bowden and Matthew Teague, and they spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers earlier this year.
It was interesting reading this book, in part because, you know, we all really just lived through it. But I found myself saying, oh, right, you know, I'd forgotten about that. As we've moved kind of farther and farther away from the 2020 election, what are some of the details that are already being obscured by time?
Well, I think all of it. I mean, I think time and memory have a way of conspiring against us in that way. But, you know, the details from the different states, it's all just sort of blurring into January 6th, I think. People remember that a little bit in isolation. And so what we tried to do is to go back and bring context to that and say, why did this happen? How did we get to this place? And to set it down so that our memories won't mislead us that way.
Yeah, I agree with Matt, Joy. So much attention has been focused on what happened in Washington on January 6th that there's a tendency to lose sight of the fact that the far more serious threat to certifying the election was the effort, the concerted effort in the six swing states, including Wisconsin, to pressure elected officials, election officials, and state legislators to, in effect, overturn the will of the people, the actual vote count. So I think, you know, what we've tried to do in The Steal is to set that story down about the people in those six states who were at the center of that fight. We write about both the people who were agitating to change the results and also the people who were duty-bound to uphold them.
As you mentioned, this book really zeroes in on personal stories. I'd like to look at one of the people featured here in Wisconsin, Ron Bishop. Tell us a bit about him.
Well, Ron is, you know, one of our favorite guys. You know, both Matt and I never expected when we started working on this book that we would discover, you know, the real heroes of the story were very often Republicans and very often, as Ron's case, avid Trump supporters. Ron is the chairman of the Republican Party in Fond du Lac. He was about as enthusiastic a supporter of Donald Trump as one could be. He put, you know, hundreds of Trump signs in his yard so that other Trump supporters could come by and pull them out and stick them in their own front yards. He held clinics for door-to-door campaigning for workers, and he was very disappointed when Donald Trump didn't win. But he was also close enough to the political process that he knew that allegations that somehow the vote was fraudulent in Wisconsin, his very own hometown, were completely wrong, and was honest enough to say so.
What's clear in reading the book, and what was clear at the time, and I think Ron Bishop's story really bears this out, everyone could see what was going to happen if Donald Trump lost. He made it pretty clear that he felt the only way he could lose was if there was fraud. So his claims weren't exactly surprising. Do you think that election officials and the Democratic Party took this threat seriously enough?
Well, I think some people did and some people didn't. There were people working all around the country, either in sort of official Trump capacities or just falling for conspiracies. And so it's difficult to get hold of that. That's part of the information or disinformation age that we live in now. Whether Democratic officials took it seriously enough, I suspect some did and tried to raise the alarm, but I think many people didn't.
Yeah, I think, Joy, a lot of people didn't because, as you know, the way elections are administered in this country is not in some federal building in Washington, D.C. They're administered by your neighbors and my neighbors and communities all across the country, and they're administered in a bipartisan way. So these election committees in states and in local communities are made up of both Republicans and Democrats. And I think Democrats who had experience working alongside Republican members of election boards respected them, certainly expected that they would do the right thing. And in fact, they did. I think what they didn't anticipate was that those very Republicans would come under attack by a faction, you know, in their own party that was an avid supporter of Donald Trump and who were willing to believe that both Democrats and Republicans had somehow united to fraudulently defeat him.
Well, and that's something we see play out here in Wisconsin, both with Ron Bishop, but also Dean Knudsen. Can you explain Dean's role in the kind of election investigations that were happening initially here in Wisconsin?
Well, I believe Dean, you know, at one point, and I think during the 2020 election, was the chairman of the State Elections Commission, and he was steeped in the mechanics of running an election, which is an extraordinarily complex thing. He had, I think, been there through the reforms, actually, under Scott Walker in Wisconsin, where a Republican-dominated state government made changes to the election laws and rules that would presumably have protected or if not benefited Republicans. So Knudsen knew what he was talking about. And his first sign of trouble came when Donald Trump began urging his supporters not to cast mail-in ballots. In fact, the state Republican Party in Wisconsin had sent out mailers urging Republican voters to vote by mail, and they even had a picture of Donald Trump on the front of it with two thumbs up, you know. And then suddenly, here was their candidate trying, you know, to discourage Republicans from casting their vote by mail, which in the eyes of anyone like Dean Knudsen or Ron Bishop, number one, there was no reason to be afraid of voting by mail. And number two, they could see that this was really going to undercut Trump's chances in Wisconsin.
As you say, the Republicans like Dean Knudsen, like Ron Bishop, who tried to advocate for mail-in voting, tried to advocate for our election processes more generally here in Wisconsin, they got a lot of backlash. Despite many Republicans now in Wisconsin having either accepted publicly or privately that the election was done fairly, we're still embroiled in an investigation into our election, and the politicians here are continuing to push for legislation that would either disenfranchise many voters or make it easier for politicians to overturn the results of an election. I guess my biggest question is, what does this say about the current state of the Republican Party, both here in Wisconsin and the U.S. more generally?
I would say very broadly that these tactics, gerrymandering or bullying or trying to sort of manipulate votes for any party, are going to be sort of temporary at best. In a representative democracy, where people feel free to voice their feelings. That's not going to work in the long term. In the long term, the only way for a party to succeed is to come up with policies that appeal to the plurality of the voters. And so in the long term, it's just not going to work.
But it is a danger. You know, and I think Matt is exactly right. It's a short-sighted strategy. And if it is successful, I would only foresee it being successful for a fairly short period of time. But by the same token, I mean, we have a system in this country, which is something that we all ought to be really proud of. I mean, for hundreds of years, we've conducted elections and peaceful transfers of power, and parties have been willing to cooperate enough to run honest elections. And especially in the, you know, the 20th century, 21st century, when it's so easy to look at election data and tell whether or not anyone has manipulated it. We know that these elections in recent years have been the fairest, most honest in all of American history. So I think we need to resist. And I'm not just talking about Democrats, I'm talking about Republicans too, need to resist this effort to tamper with and somehow stack our election system so that the votes of the people are not counted fairly and accurately and can be set aside by, you know, one partisan group or the other.
Well, Matt, Mark, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you. You're welcome.
It's been a pleasure.
Mark Bowden and Matthew Teague are the authors of The Steal, the attempt to overturn the 2020 election and the people who stopped it. They both spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers in January. In about 20 minutes, we'll look at what parts of Milwaukee are becoming less segregated and where the problem persists. But first, we'll look back on some memorable moments from political conventions and explore how influential they are now. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It's looking like Milwaukee will be the host city at the Republican National Convention in 2024. A GOP site selection panel picked this city and is awaiting full approval from the Republican National Committee, which could come later this week. The role of political conventions in modern America is a tradition that may not hold as much influence now since we hold primary elections. Up until 1831, presidential nominees were essentially made by party members in what was called a King Caucus. So do conventions still matter? To help us look back at influential moments in convention history, I spoke with Kenneth Davis, author of the I Don't Know Much About History series. Kenneth Davis, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you for joining me today.
It's a great pleasure to be with you. Thank you, Audrey.
I want to look back at the role of conventions overall. So historically, what has that role been for Americans?
Well, you have to talk about historically in sort of two phases, because for much of the early history of the presidency, there was no convention. There was no convention to nominate Thomas Jefferson or some of the early presidents. It really came about in the 1830s, curiously because of a third party called the Anti-Masonic Party, which had a decision to hold a convention. Before that time, presidential nominees were made essentially by party members in what they called the caucus. And up until the 1830s, it was known as King Caucus. You have to remember a little bit that people like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison all railed against parties. There's nothing in the Constitution that talks about parties. And Washington in particular was very worried about the future of American politics if it devolved into what he called factions. But of course it did almost immediately, because that is the way politics naturally works. It's interesting because the movement towards the convention was an early form of people wanting more democracy, not allowing powerful men, and of course they all were men, choosing other men to make these decisions. They wanted to give it more of a voice to the people. And so the idea of the convention comes about in 1830. As I mentioned, the first one was actually a third party of sorts called the Anti-Masonic Party. This was a group of men who believed that the Masonry was a dangerous conspiracy against America. So that is an idea that goes back to our political roots as well, the idea that there are powerful secret organizations running things. Among the anti-Masons, I should point out, was a future president of the United States, Millard Fillmore. So this idea was actually picked up then by the two other key parties at the time, the Democrats, and at that time it was the Whig Party. Later, of course, the Republican Party is invented.
So we have the start of nominating conventions with the Anti-Masonic Convention, and another third-party significance convention I'd like to point to is 1912, the Republican Convention. So this is Theodore Roosevelt's Bull Moose Party, which many would argue is the most successful third-party campaign.
It was absolutely the most successful third-party campaign. Roosevelt, as a third-party candidate, actually finished second in the balloting that year to Woodrow Wilson, who ultimately became the president. And that's a really fascinating election. Just to fill in a little bit, between 1830 and 1912, the parties had evolved, obviously. The Republican Party came into existence in the 1850s. Its first successful presidential nominee, of course, Abraham Lincoln in 1860. But this was not still very much men getting together in closed rooms and making the big decisions. What we think of as the primary process today really did not exist until the 20th century. It was a sort of an outgrowth of the progressive movement that wanted to increase the amount of democracy. But that's what made the convention still so important for most of American political history. This really was the place where, sometimes in so-called smoke-filled rooms, the decisions were made about who the candidate would be, and very often also, very importantly, who the vice presidential candidate would be. In 1912, you have an interesting situation because you do have the Republican Party divided very, very sharply between the sitting incumbent president, William Howard Taft, and President Theodore Roosevelt, who'd left office and decided 4 years later that he wanted to go back. He wasn't particularly happy with his successor Taft, and he chose to run again. And the Republican convention was split very seriously. They did nominate Taft. Roosevelt goes ahead and starts his own party, the Progressive Party, better known as the Bull Moose Party, because Roosevelt had actually been shot and declared to the journalists that he was as strong and healthy as a bull moose.
And that actually happened here in Milwaukee, where he was shot.
That is correct. So a piece of presidential history right there. And so this was an extraordinary moment in American political history, and perhaps one of the most extraordinary elections in history. I contend that Wilson really wins the election that year. He had a very, very stunning electoral victory. But when you look at the states that had gone Republican in the previous two elections that went to Wilson, it was because Taft and Roosevelt clearly split the vote in 1912, the Republican vote. If one or the other of them had dropped out of the race, it's a good, you can make a good case that Wilson would not have won the 1912 election. So here's a quick case clearly of a third party candidate actually throwing the whole election into chaos.
Going forward a bit to 1932, the Democratic Convention. So the country is in the midst of the Great Depression, and Democrats were hopefully set up to take over the GOP's long hold on the White House. And it took a bit of time, but eventually FDR was anointed on the fourth ballot. And this is where he had his famous A New Deal speech.
That's correct. And that's why I count this as among the most significant of modern political conventions. It also gets a footnote to history because Roosevelt then, and we're talking about Franklin D. Roosevelt as opposed to Theodore Roosevelt, became the first candidate to address the convention. In the past, it was kind of considered unseemly for the candidate to go to these conventions. He was supposed to be kind of above the fray. And political campaigning, in fact, up until the 1930s, was often really done from your back porch. Famously, Harding and others had just sat on the porch and reporters would come to them. The idea of barnstorming the country and going around the country and campaigning was seen as somehow ungentlemanly, and it wasn't done. But that was all going to change, as so many things were changing because of the advent of mass media. Radio had come to the fore. And of course, when Roosevelt addresses the convention in 1932, millions of Americans are able to hear this for the first time. And this also changed the roles of conventions in American politics because it became much more of a public spectacle that was carried live on radio and eventually would, of course, be carried live on television.
One of the things I've been thinking about as you've been alluding to how conventions were in the past, especially the very much behind the scenes aspect, you know, it wasn't until recent history that Americans could hear FDR over the radio and otherwise were definitely not in the room where it happened, so to speak. So do you believe that the average American doesn't really understand the impact or past significance of conventions because it's something that wasn't wildly shared? You know, we see voting as a central part of our participation in a democratic process, but a lot of people don't really know what happens at a convention besides, like, maybe the nominating speech or what comes of a convention.
Right. You know, in the pre-internet, pre-cable television days, the big deal was that networks were going to offer gavel-to-gavel coverage, as they would put it in those days. And for, you know, 3 or 4 nights, the nation really did pay attention to these conventions, the build-up, the nominating speeches, because these candidates typically had not been determined yet, and then the roll call of the ballots as each state got up to deliver its choices for the nominee. And there was a tremendous sense of drama built into that, even though in many cases the nominee was already determined or was clearly established, was still this element of a spectacle and a show. And I think that television certainly amplified and magnified that. 1960, before 1960, there had been televised conventions, but most people still didn't have a television. It's not until the 1950s, and then certainly 1960, when John F. Kennedy, who was this incredibly telegenic candidate, gets the nomination, that people are really watching the conventions in a much more realistic way.
So we have 1960 as the first widely televised convention. And this also set the stage for the first televised debate with John F. Kennedy. And then with the 1968 Democratic National Convention, the attention was drawn not necessarily just to what was happening inside these convention halls, but television also played a huge role when large protests were formed outside of the Democratic National Convention facility in Chicago. Can you explain the significance of that?
Yeah, it's again, it's a moment that I remember living through very clearly as a young man. I was still a teenager, but very much politically aware. And certainly we have to reflect for a moment on what 1968 meant. It was the year in which first we had the Tet Offensive. The Vietnam War was going on, and Americans had been told for years by Lyndon Johnson and his generals that the light was at the end of the tunnel and it was almost over and we were going, the victory was around the corner. The Tet Offensive comes and completely shatters the illusion and the lies that have been given to the American people. Shortly after that, Lyndon B. Johnson, who is the sitting president, elected by a landslide in 1964 after having succeeded Kennedy, withdraws and decides he's not going to run again. It was a stunning moment, largely because of a primary, the primary in New Hampshire, in which the anti-war candidate, Eugene McCarthy, didn't defeat Johnson, but came close. And this was a stunning moment. So Johnson withdraws. Within a few weeks of that withdrawal, we have the assassination of Martin Luther King. Robert F. Kennedy speaks about that assassination and calms the nation. And a few weeks later in June, he is also assassinated. So it was against this backdrop of the war going bad, Lyndon Johnson's withdrawal, the assassinations of these two extraordinary figures in American history, that the Democrats go to Chicago and they are going to go in the midst of a major anti-war demonstration that became a full-scale riot, a riot which later on was determined was really set in motion by the police. It was described as a police riot. And newsmen who were on the floor of the convention covering the convention were actually rough-handled or manhandled, and in some cases, if they were out on the street, beaten, a kind of precursor to what we saw in 2020 in Portland and other places as news media covering protests became part of the violence against the protesters. That happened in 1968, and of course, it was an extraordinary moment in American history, and produced Hubert Humphrey, Johnson's vice president, as the Democratic candidate that year. He lost in a very, very close race, of course, to Richard Nixon.
So speaking on a little more recent history, relatively speaking, what kind of impact have these most recent conventions had?
Well, the most important thing to realize about more recent the conventions since the late 1990s into the early 2000s is that the primary system then had really come into the fore. And in most of these cases, the nominees were determined before the convention meets. The convention takes on a different importance because of who was speaking in a way. Now, keynotes have always been significant, but it's hard to remember too many keynote speeches. Although I remember Bill Clinton giving one a while ago, and it was dreadful before his election when he was still the governor of Arkansas. And many people thought it was the end of his political career. It was such a bad speech. On the other extreme, you have 2004, and a young senator from Illinois, a freshman senator from Illinois, is introduced to the American people, of course, Barack Obama. That convention really propels Obama to national stature. And of course, it would be a few years later that he would win the nomination. Again, in a pretty much determined before the convention meets because of the primary system, with Obama's defeat of Hillary Clinton in the primary season. So by 2008, the primary has taken precedence over the convention, and it's increasingly just seen as this celebratory moment, a moment to bring the party together behind the candidate to try and get some sense of unity, and put on a great big show that gets everybody excited to go out and campaign. And that's what the convention had essentially evolved into by the early 2000s.
Kenneth Davis is the author of the Don't Know Much About History series. He's also written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Smithsonian Magazine. He joined me in 2020. Did you know that you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Well, if you'd like to take us on the go or hear any of the segments on the show, just search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen to your podcasts to hear us on demand. You can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Lake Effect interviews. Milwaukee is known as one of the most segregated cities in the country. Next, we'll look at where that has and has not changed. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Milwaukee still has work to do in order to become a fair place for all people to live. The city is one of the most segregated cities in the country, and according to recent census data, the Milwaukee metro area still ranks as the second most segregated city between black and white populations. But at the same time, neighborhoods and some suburbs have seen significant changes in demographics. John Johnson is a research fellow at Marquette University in the Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education. He recently dissected 2020 census data to map out and identify Milwaukee's neighborhoods that aren't segregated. Johnson spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang about where these neighborhoods are and where deep segregation continues.
According to Brown University's Diversity and Disparities Project, metro-wide black and white segregation declined slightly, but in the Milwaukee metro area still ranks as the second most segregated, just as it did in 2010. And just to start off, what counties were included in the Milwaukee metro area data, and what exactly does this mean that this metro area is the second most segregated in the country when looking at Milwaukee's black population and Milwaukee's white population?
Yeah, the metro area consists of Milwaukee County plus the three WOW counties, Waukesha, Ozaukee, and Washington. Metropolitan areas are defined by the federal government based on commuting patterns and where people live. We see frustratingly little change compared to 2010. So everything you have heard in the past about segregation in the Milwaukee area is still true. There is a small amount of change, particularly in certain suburbs. So Brown Deer, West Milwaukee, and increasingly West Dallas and Wauwatosa see growing levels of integration. But for the most part, it's still very segregated metro area, particularly on the Black-White segregation axis.
You use a term called using the diversity index to measure these areas of the city. And just to clarify and to define this early on, how was this used and how should this measurement be understood?
For each neighborhood in Milwaukee with a large enough population, I calculated their 2020 census population by race and ethnicity. And then I calculated something called a diversity index, which is the likelihood that if you met any two people at random from that neighborhood, that they would identify with a different racial or ethnic group.
And also, I'm just curious too, I know we specifically talked about segregation between black and white populations. What are the segregation rates between other racial groups in Milwaukee, and have any specific populations in the city of Milwaukee grown since 2010?
Yes, the Latino and Asian populations in Milwaukee have both grown very significantly over the past decade. In fact, that's where the real population growth in the metro area and the city is among those two groups. And the segregation indices you can calculate a segregation index between any two groups, but the segregation between non-Hispanic white people and Latino people of any race is less than the segregation, significantly less than the segregation between black people and white people in Milwaukee. But Asian is, you know, it's not a super useful category because it encompasses so many different ethnicities. So in the Milwaukee area, you have, you know, the Hmong population and the Karen population and the Rohingya population. Probably the most Rohingya people live in Milwaukee as in any American city, according to the State Department. And there are different sort of geographic tendencies in each of those groups.
Gotcha. And Milwaukee's population dropped by about 17,600 people since 2010 and is at its lowest since 1930. How does this factor into any conversations that we have about diversification?
Yeah, so it's a good question. White flight is still happening, and the end of the residency requirement in the middle of the decade seems like it probably accentuated that. Thousands of city employees, particularly cops, firefighters, and then also a lot of MPS employees moved out of the city. And all our evidence suggests is that the majority of those people were white. Interestingly, we see a significant increase in diversity in the neighborhoods that those city employees left behind, particularly on the far southwest and northwest sides of the city. So those are still popular neighborhoods to live in, and the exit of some people from those neighborhoods meant that other people would have the opportunity to buy a house or sign a lease in those places. But a large In fact, the main reason why Milwaukee's population is declining is because we're just aging. People have fewer kids, fewer people have kids at all. And consequently, our population is just shrinking. The number of babies that were born in Milwaukee during the 2010s was about 16,000 fewer than the number of babies born in Milwaukee 18 years prior. It's just a natural thing that's happening here. It happened to the white population first, the decline in the birth rate, but now we see a similar level of having children in the Black population in Milwaukee. And the more recent immigrant groups to Milwaukee are following the same trend. This happens in Milwaukee and it happens everywhere else in the country. And so this is just a trend that's going to proceed into the future. It's not really a bad thing or a good thing. It's just what happens. But I think that the declining population, thanks to fewer people having children and declining family sizes, is going to be one of the issues that Milwaukee and every other community will need to grapple with in the next couple decades.
I can say, like, personally, I see more dogs than babies recently in my neighborhood. I feel like some people can resonate with that.
Yeah, it might say something about the neighborhood that you live in, too. It's interesting. Most of the new construction, I'm not sure where you live, but most of the new construction in Milwaukee are studios and one bedroom and maybe two bedroom condos and apartments that are geared towards either young professionals or retirees, but not families with kids.
And I just want to highlight, too, in your findings, you found that Milwaukee's most diverse neighborhoods tend to be working or lower middle class and are located in one of the three clusters on the south, west, and northwest sides. And the least diverse neighborhoods are on the deeply segregated near north side of the city where residents are predominantly Black. And then just to highlight, too, along with other neighborhoods such as the historic Third Ward and the Upper East Side where residents are predominantly white. How does class and socioeconomic status play into this creation of diversity or even lack of diversity within our city's neighborhoods?
So just to restate the point that you already made, by this diversity index calculation, which is the likelihood that any two people you might meet at random in a neighborhood identify with different racial or ethnic groups, the very most segregated neighborhoods by that metric are on the near north side and they're majority Black neighborhoods. But also in the top 20 most segregated neighborhoods out of Milwaukee's more than 150 neighborhoods are places like the Third Ward, the Upper East Side, Fernwood, and Downer Woods. So I kind of think about Milwaukee as having name brand neighborhoods. These are the places that you read about when the Washington Post or the New York Times writes a visit Milwaukee, this quaint city on the Great Lakes. I'm always curious to see what places they recommend tourists visit. And they're usually those neighborhoods ranging from the Third Ward up through the East Side. And those are quantitatively some of the very most segregated places in Milwaukee. Those are the richest and poorest neighborhoods in the city. The function of racism is to make people poor. So poverty is what maintains hypersegregation on the near north side, and lack of access to wealth is what keeps people who might otherwise want to live on the Upper East Side from being able to move there. People describe Milwaukee as a tale of two cities, often reflecting that divide. I've heard Reggie Jackson describe how much you can learn just driving down North Avenue through Milwaukee and seeing the changes as you pass from the East Side through the near North Side to the West Side and then ultimately into the suburbs. And that metaphor of a tale of two cities does capture something very important about the city and about those hypersegregated areas. I think it's worth remembering that there are these parts of the city that are pretty integrated, where if you meet two people by chance, it's more likely than not that they will identify with different races. And I think it's instructive that those neighborhoods are not the name brand neighborhoods of Milwaukee. They're not the places you're going to read about in magazine articles. They're very working class kinds of places. So there's this cluster that stretches from about the airport to Alverno College. There's another one from Washington Park to Miller Valley. This includes Martin Drive and Pigsville, perhaps the best named neighborhood in Milwaukee, although I think they're trying to rebrand to the Valley. Personally, I think Pigsville is great and they should stick with it. And then there's this other cluster of neighborhoods on the far northwest side of the city close to Dretzka Park. These include like the Little Menominee Parkway, Pheasant Run, and Forest Highlands. And all three of these clusters of neighborhoods are quite diverse and have remained so over the past decade. But they're the kinds of places where a couple who both have working class jobs and a couple kids can easily afford to buy a house and raise their family there. It's critically important to, you know, be clear and blunt about the segregation that Milwaukee faces. And I think it's also important for those of us who care about this city to look for reasons to be hopeful that are within Milwaukee and not just in other cities, and be like, why can't we be like these other cities that are doing better on some of these metrics than we are? And so to me, I take some encouragement from the fact that there are actually stably integrated parts of Milwaukee. And depending on where you live, you may not be aware of that, because as I said earlier, these aren't neighborhoods that have a lot of famous attractions that people come to from other parts of the city. I would just encourage anyone listening to this who's maybe surprised to learn about this to spend some time exploring parts of Milwaukee on the far south and far west and far northwest sides of the city. There's a lot of wonderful neighborhoods in Milwaukee everywhere.
John Johnson is a research fellow at Marquette University in the Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang in April. And that's Lake Effect for today. Thank you so much for being with us. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations or you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll tell you about the recent changes to election laws in Wisconsin and tell you how you can cast your ballot in the August primary election next week. Plus, we'll tell you about 5 events happening in Milwaukee this month. That's tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.